This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
A dog believes his master is at the door, but can he also believe his master will come the day after tomorrow? A question posed by the 20th century Austrian-born philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. But what kinds of minds do animals have? What do they think? What are they capable of thinking about? What do they believe? Tim Crane, Professor of Philosophy at Cambridge, has some human thoughts and beliefs on the matter.
Tim Crane, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thanks, Nigel.
The topic we're going to focus on is animal minds. Some philosophers in the past have thought that animals don't have minds at all.
That's right. Descartes, I suppose, is the most famous philosopher who said that explicitly, that animals don't think because they don't have language and they don't have a soul. Now, the interesting thing is that that's one of the very few discussions, really, of the minds of animals in Western philosophy. And what's strange is that there have been so few discussions because it's such a fascinating philosophical question.
So few discussions, and the one prominent one getting it so badly wrong. I mean, anybody who's spent time with higher mammals will know that they have some kind of thought.
Absolutely. There are two obviously incorrect answers to the question of what do animals think. The first obviously incorrect answer is Descartes', which is that they don't think at all. But on the other hand, the equally obviously incorrect answer is that they think exactly the same things that we think and they think about the same things that we think. And we know that both these answers are wrong. The truth must lie somewhere in the middle. So it's rather similar to the question of the moral status of animals. There are two equally bad answers there. One answer is that animals have no moral status at all, that we have no obligation to care about their suffering or the conditions of their life. And the other equally bad answer is that they have exactly the same status as us and that we should expect the same moral behaviour from animals as we expect from other people. And that's not true either. The truth must lie somewhere in the middle.
I wouldn't want to advocate the view that the truth always lies in the middle, but I do agree here, it must, surely with the mind of an animal, it must lie somewhere in between the idea that they have no mind and that they have a mind that's very much like ours. Yet, in the case of animals like chimpanzees, it could be pretty close to our mind. The mind of a chimpanzee is a social animal. It's not that different in physique from a human being. Surely we could say that there might be something very similar to our thought processes going on.
Well, you're right that we are remarkably similar to chimpanzees. We share an enormous proportion of our genetic material with them. But when it comes to the question of what they think, there are difficulties in how to even begin approaching that question. I think we need to distinguish two things. One is the question of the nature of an animal's consciousness, that is, what it's like to be that animal, from the animal's point of view, so to speak, and the nature of the animal's thought, in the sense of what kinds of things are the animals capable of thinking about, what kind of things are they capable of reasoning about. Let's concentrate on the question of what kind of things they think, the question of animals' thoughts, what they think about. You mentioned that chimpanzees are social animals, and that's absolutely true. And one of the things that social animals do is that they interact with other animals. One question is about the nature of this interaction. Do animals communicate with each other? Obviously, yes. So what sort of things do they communicate about? One debate in the study of animal cognition is about whether animals communicate by just simply affecting the behaviour of other animals, doing things to stimulate other animals to bring about some behaviour, which is communication in a sense, or whether they communicate something in more like the way we communicate by, for example, drawing attention to things in the environment. Now, what sort of evidence could there be that there's this distinction between merely getting an animal, another animal, to do something and communicating information to that animal? There's a fascinating study going back to the 1970s by Cheney and Seyfarth, who studied the vervet monkeys in their actual habitat in Africa. And they discovered that these monkeys make different kinds of cries, alarm calls, to indicate the presence of different kinds of predators. So one kind of alarm call seems to be tied to the presence of leopards, another is responding to the presence of snakes, and another one is responding to the presence of eagles. And the interesting thing is that these alarm calls are correlated with different avoidance behavior on behalf of the monkeys who hear them. The monkeys who hear the leopard alarm will run up the tree, even when the leopard is out of sight. The monkeys who hear the eagle alarm will go under the bush, and the monkeys who hear the snake alarm will start looking around on the ground.
It seems to me in that case you could go two ways. You could say all these are three different calls getting animals to do different things. So they're not actually referring to a leopard, a snake, or a vulture. They are pushing people in different directions. So they're not referential calls, as it were. They're simply spurs to activity. The other way you could go is say, well, look, they can name things. They can name a leopard. The monkey thinks, oh, leopard, I must take the avoidance action that you have to when a leopard's in the vicinity. And surely the former is more likely in a way.
Well, that's a really good question. It's impossible to answer that question from the philosopher's armchair, so we need to look and see what the empirical studies actually show. But what the philosopher can do is distinguish questions like that and suggest different ways, different conceptual tools that could be used in order to divide up the different cases. So Daniel Dennett, for example, has famously discussed what he calls the intentional stance. The intentional stance is taking an attitude to a certain creature or an object, treating it as if it was a thinker, and see how far you get with that, and see whether you can accurately predict its behaviour on those grounds. So Daniel Dennett suggests that in the vervet monkey case, we should start off by taking the intentional stance to the vervet monkeys, treating them as if they have beliefs and desires and intentions and hopes and all these attitudes that we think of as very human things, and see how far we get. Now, in the case of humans, of course, we can distinguish between someone who hears an alarm call and runs away, and then we can think of someone who hears an alarm call and thinks, well, if they're up for a fight, I'll be up for a fight too, and they can take someone on, or someone who wants to, say, take a lot of risks and risk their life, or someone wants to commit suicide and run into the jaws of death. So there are all sorts of pieces of behaviour that can be thought of as responses to alarm calls in the human case. In the monkey case, it's much harder for us to actually pull those things apart.
So this is an example of a piece of empirical research that raises interesting issues, but it doesn't seem to answer any of those issues. Is there something that could give us some progress in philosophy here, some way in which we can get beyond the wildly speculative thoughts about what a chimpanzee or a monkey might actually be thinking or thinking about?
Well, I don't think it's wildly speculative. I think it is actually tied to the data. To make progress here, I think there are a number of different methods that we can use. And of course, one of them is paying close attention to the empirical data. But another one is contrasting things, contrasting the way we talk about our thoughts with the way we talk about thoughts of animals. So it's very natural for us to think that we know what it is to think. We know what it is to have a thought about the world. We know what it is to have a desire for a cool drink or something like this. But when we start thinking about it, it's not so obvious that we know what these things are. I think that you, Nigel, have a similar kind of mind to me and that you can think about similar things to me. We know that because we share a language. But is it so obvious that what it's like to be Nigel is exactly the same as what it's like to be me and that we have similar kind of thought processes going on? The gap between you and a gorilla or a chimpanzee is even more enormous.
As philosophers and as human beings, we want to know about higher mammals. They're pretty close to us biologically, genetically. But can we? What methodology is there for a philosopher or a psychologist to discover anything about a chimpanzee's world?
Well, the only real method is by looking at their behaviour. And the obstacle that they present to us is the fact that they don't speak. Given that, psychologists are very good at working out tests for different kinds of thought and distinguishing different kinds of thoughts among apes. Let me give you an example. There's a very famous experiment with a submissive and dominant chimpanzee in a cage, and they can both see a bowl of food in front of them. If left in that condition, the submissive chimpanzee lets the dominant take the food first. An opaque barrier is then placed between the dominant chimpanzee and the food, but the submissive chimpanzee can still see the food and can see the dominant chimpanzee. The dominant can't see the food, but the submissive one can and is aware of the opaque barrier between the food and the dominant. In that circumstance, the submissive one always goes for the food. Now, some psychologists concluded from that the best explanation of that situation was that the submissive chimp could see that the dominant couldn't see. Now, if the submissive can see that the dominant couldn't see, or come to know that the dominant couldn't see, then the submissive chimp has an idea of the mind of another animal, of something going on in the mind of a conspecific, a member of their species. And that's a fantastic result, if it's true. It's controversial, but it's persuaded me.
It's persuaded you that a chimpanzee could have a theory, as it were, about what's going on in another mind. So that puts it on a different level from animals lower down the animal kingdom, as it were, who presumably aren't going to be like that.
Exactly. I mean, one question is where the line is between those animals that can think and those animals that can't think. And of course, there isn't a sharp line. But another question is, where's the line or the distinction between those animals which can think about the thoughts of other animals and those animals which can't? And that is called, in the animal psychology literature, having a theory of mind. So the question is, do chimps have a theory of mind? This was a famous question asked about 30-odd years ago. And at the moment, there's a broad consensus that in some sense of theory, the chimps do have a theory of mind in the sense that they can recognize the intentions and knowledge of other members of their species.
So what hangs on that? Why is that interesting philosophically?
Well, I think it's intrinsically interesting to know what's going on in the minds of animals. Philosophically, there are all sorts of connections. There's the question about how the chimp's theory of mind relates to our own theory of mind. The consensus is among many psychologists and philosophers now that the best way of testing for a theory of mind is something called the false belief test. The false belief test is a test which is given to children to test when they have the concept of belief. Because in order to have the concept of belief, you have to have the concept of something being correct or incorrect or true or false. You can't have the concept of belief without having the concept of false belief. The test is normally done by showing children a little play with some dolls. The first doll, Sally, comes in to the room and puts a piece of chocolate in a drawer. Sally then leaves the room. The next doll, Anne, comes in and takes the piece of chocolate out of the drawer and puts it in another drawer. Sally then comes back into the room and the child is asked, where does Sally think the chocolate is? If the child says that Sally thinks the chocolate is where Anne put it, then the child doesn't pass the false belief test. The reason is the child thinks that Sally knows everything that he or she knows. If, on the other hand, the child says Sally thinks that the chocolate is where she originally left it, then the child passes the false belief test because the child has the concept that Sally is in error. That's the false belief test. It's very hard to imagine how you could apply it to chimps. For the moment, the interesting thing is that we seem to have evidence that the child's theory of mind, when they come to have the theory of mind, is very different from the chimp's theory of mind. To go back to the submissive and dominant chimp, the submissive chimp knows that the dominant cannot see something. So the submissive chimp knows that the dominant is ignorant of the location of the food. But that doesn't mean that the submissive chimp knows that the dominant has a false belief about the location of the food. The dominant just has no view whatsoever because there's just a screen in between them and the food. If we compare these two cases, the false belief test plus our experiment with the two chimps, we can make a distinction between the kind of theory of mind that the chimp has, which is much coarser, operates with categories like knowledge and ignorance, maybe, as opposed to the more sophisticated theory of mind that the child has, which incidentally really only comes when they acquire a language, where they can distinguish between not just ignorance and knowledge, but also between belief, true belief, and false belief.
That is fascinating. Could it be that the difference isn't just in having language, but that the chimp's life is so radically different from a child's life? It's more a question of what do they need in their world to get by? Do they need a concept of false belief? Do they need to have a theory of mind in order to live in the jungle, pursuing the kind of prey and food that they do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it must be right that you can't just derive your views about what an animal's thought is by, say, looking at how similar they are to us. If you think of the animals that we communicate with the most, those are dogs, in fact. Most of us are much better at communicating with dogs than we are with chimps, and chimps are rather actually nasty and disagreeable little animals. Dogs, on the other hand, are creatures that we communicate with very well, but of course we're very far on the evolutionary ladder. We're very far away from them. Why do we communicate with them so well? Because we've evolved together. Dogs evolved with us. Arguably, we selected them on the basis of their ability to communicate with us. So there are all sorts of things that dogs do because of the world that they inhabit, which chimps don't do, like, for example, following the gazes of humans, knowing where a human is looking. Dogs often try and make eye contact with you. So all those kind of things that are a result of the environment and the needs of the environment, rather than just the genetic similarity to us. On the question of the difference between the chimp's theory of mind and the human theory of mind, it's a very interesting question why that should be so, why we need a concept of false belief and why the chimp doesn't, if the chimp doesn't have such a concept. And I'd like to connect it to the question of what it is that language gives us. I don't think it's a coincidence that the time at which children start passing the false belief test is the time at which they become linguistically mature. It seems that our ability to learn a language carries with it the ability to represent other things as true or false, so represent the thoughts of others as being correct or incorrect. And because the fact that it's language that gives us the ability to represent truth and falsehood would explain then why the chimps themselves don't have such an ability, since they don't have language.
Obviously, there's a lot of empirical work going on in this area. Is there any role for a philosopher here?
Well, I think so. In one way, this is one of the boundaries of science. Philosophy often gets started at the boundaries of science when people don't really know what categories to use in order to understand the phenomena. I think in this case, we don't really know exactly how to make progress because there's such a difficulty in applying these mental concepts to creatures where we cannot communicate with them linguistically. So there is a difficulty in applying the concept of belief to an animal. For example, you know, if I attribute to you the belief that it's a sunny day, then I'm attributing to you too the concept of a day. And the concept of a day goes along with the concept of time, the concept of a year. A day is a period of time within a year. There are 365 days in the year. And these are the kind of things you have to think in order to have the concept of a day. Can I attribute to an animal the belief that it's a sunny day? Well, on the one hand, you know, you see the dog basking in the sun and you see it aware of the sun. It can see the sun. It's got eyes. It can be warmed by the sun. On the other hand, can the dog have a concept of a day? Well, maybe it has. Maybe it notices when the sun goes down and when it wakes up in the morning. What does it take to have the concept of a day? What does it take to have the belief that it's a sunny day? So again, we're torn. On the one hand, you want to say, of course the dog is aware that it's a sunny day. But on the other hand, our normal practice of attributing beliefs to people makes it rather difficult to do this. So I see that as very philosophical, not because there's a special method that we need in order to answer the question, but because I think that philosophy is a result of confusion as much as ignorance. And I think there's a lot of confusion here.
You're a specialist in the philosophy of mind, human minds predominantly. Do you think there's anything that we can learn from the study of animal minds that will enlighten us about the nature of consciousness, the nature of the human mind?
Yes. When we look at what animals lack and see what we have, this helps us to get clearer about the special distinctive nature of human thought. There are clear differences between human thought and animal thought, but we don't know really exactly how to describe them. My hypothesis is that the distinctive feature of human thought is the ability to think about things without thinking about their practical consequences, to thinking about things, so to speak, for their own sake. Pursuit of truth for its own sake is something which I think is characteristic of human thinking, and I think actually it was an evolutionary adaptation. It gave us the ability to learn things without learning the immediate point of them, and that has been an enormous advantage to us in the development of culture.
Tim Crane, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Nigel.
There's now a Philosophy Bites book published by Oxford University Press. For more information, go to www.philosophybites.com.
For more information about the Institute, go to www.philosophy.sas.ac.uk.